Hello, welcome to the Netzpolitik.org podcast. I'm Andre, and my guest today is Rebel. Hey, Rebel, just briefly tell us who you are, where you're from, and what you do.
Hi, I'm Rebel. I'm a net activist and software developer. I was the first employee and sort of architect and lead developer at the company that made Twitter.
Okay, we're at Ohm Conference, I forgot to say that, 2013 Hacker Conference in the camp in the Netherlands. And last night you held a talk on the roots of Twitter and its activist connections. So what was your role in the creation of Twitter?
Twitter was created as a side project of another company called Odeo, and I was the lead developer and the architect of that. And along with another developer on the team, we started experimenting with SMS for activist groups to coordinate stuff. And so we worked with another group that was building something called TextMob. And we looked at this idea of open text messages between groups of people. And we brought it back into the company and we said, okay, what's interesting in TextMob? How does this work? How do we build something better, more usable, and a little more fluid than that? And so we did a whole series of iterations on products in that space and came up with Twitter after the course of a couple months of building prototypes.
So what was Twitter in the beginning?
Twitter was a cell phone-only text messaging social network. So to sign up for it, you had to use your cell phone and send text messages. That's why it's limited to 140 characters, because of the limit of an SMS. And the idea was to limit down what you could say and make it super quick and fluid, so you could say it without having it be too important. The sort of artists are more creative within limits of the medium.
If I remember correctly, in the beginning, Twitter was framed as tell your friends what you're doing right now. Was that the case? What was the point, and what did you think of it back then?
Sure. The idea originally was the publish stuff on Twitter that is too insignificant to bother telling your friends about. You know, you have things in English. You have this phrase of writing home. So if something's really important, you say that you're going to write a letter home, or you write a letter to your mom about it. Well, Twitter is the opposite. It's something that's so insignificant that it's not important enough to tell your friends when you meet up with them for coffee or at a bar.
And how did that evolve into one of the biggest social networks that it is today?
Well, that's a good question. It always appeared initially to be very geeky. I mean, you have these codes and these text messages and these very short messages, and you had to try to fit all the text in there. And it was never obvious from the beginning that it was something that was going to become sort of massively adopted. But it turns out that stripping away all the barriers to communication makes it easier. And it makes it so that it's sort of this constant sort of whatever is on the top of people's mind, the sort of churn that's in people's mind gets spewed out in Twitter. And that means that it's very easy to know the pulse of society, the pulse of different groups and what they're thinking about.
So you said in the beginning Twitter was only usable via SMS. Didn't that produce hundreds of dollars of phone bills? And also, when did that change?
So for the first 2 or 3 months, the only way to sign up for Twitter and the only way to join it was via SMS. And at the time in the United States, you had to pay to receive SMSs. And so people ran up hundreds and hundreds of dollar phone bills just to use Twitter. And that's actually incredibly useful when you think about a service, because it meant that people were paying for Twitter. They just weren't paying Twitter for Twitter. They were paying the telephone companies for Twitter. But they had the value to keep using it. And so then the question was, if something is so valuable to them that way, how do you make it less expensive and more accessible? So the API was added, and then there were Twitter clients, and there was ability to get RSS feeds, and there was ability to sort of branch out and view and participate in Twitter in many different forms. And it became a hub as opposed to a destination website.
In your talk, you mentioned that, I remember that at one time Twitter was accessible via XMPP, the Jabber protocol. And also you mentioned, which was new to me, that at one time Twitter was actually federated with another social network. Explain those, please.
So for a long time, the XMPP features were published. And so you could interact with any kind of Jabber client or with another Jabber server and send and receive tweets. And so this was a really neat way of building out the real-time web of communication back and forth. The developer that really pushed forward and maintained the server got in a disagreement with the direction of the company, and he left. And then after he left, no one knew how to maintain the XMPP servers. And so, unfortunately, the service went away. The same developer also pushed through the idea of federated Twitter, this idea that Twitter is not the destination or the single website, but it's a federation of services that do the same thing. So similar to the way IRC or email or RSS works, that Twitter could be a similar medium. Unfortunately, the first place they federated with, Jaiku, got very quickly bought by Google. And then neither the Google people nor the Twitter management wanted to continue this experiment in federation. And so it was a path not taken, although the code was written. I mean, and then afterwards, a number of developers who worked at Twitter on various core parts of the platform have continued to advocate internally that Twitter should be federated. There should be this kind of open network and Twitter should be a medium. And unfortunately, the engineers who built Twitter didn't get to decide where the platform and the company went.
Yesterday, you also made the distinction between Twitter as a platform and Twitter as a company. That sounds to me really linked to these problems that developers actually wanted to be open, want to do the cool, nerdy, making the world a better place stuff. And that got, or many of those things got slammed down by marketing. Is that so? And do you have more stories like this?
Sure. It's complicated because the company grew and changed over time. But first, remember that Twitter, the company, was a side project and one of many side projects for the first 6 months, first year or so. And the idea was always to build other projects. So it had a fair degree of autonomy to grow separate from the idea of any kind of business concerns. And it flowered and grew and created an incredible platform there. And then as Twitter got more valuable and got more attention and investors, there was a need to figure out what is the business model? How is it going to make money? And unfortunately, that business model didn't end up being directly aligned with some of the developers' more utopian views on what is it. And it's a for-profit company. I mean, in some way, you can't criticize it and the management for figuring out how to make a profit as a for-profit company that got investment. I mean, that's what you would expect it to do. And if they didn't do that, then Twitter would go out of business and the site would shut down. So I think it's unfortunate the path that's taken, but I'm not sure that the people who made those decisions were making the wrong decisions themselves.
So you were working at Odeo, the company that created Twitter as kind of a side project. At what time did you drop out of that and why? And what was your relation to Twitter back then?
So I dropped out about 3 or 4 months after Twitter itself was launched. And at the time, we were maintaining both Odeo and a number of other side projects in Twitter. And I dropped out because I didn't see a big future in Twitter. I think, you know, there's in Silicon Valley, there's 1,000 startups and lots and lots of them seem like they're going to change the world and be a very big deal. And most of the time they don't. And Twitter didn't have any indication that it was going to be any more likely to do that than any of the other ones. Also, just was, you know, the burnout of working 16-hour days without any vacation for a couple of years. It's hard. And sometimes you want to move on.
So yesterday your talk was titled The Activist Backgrounds of Twitter. You've already mentioned this tool called TextMob. What are the other connections to activism and how did they influence in what Twitter became?
So a number of people on the team at Odeo that created Twitter had been involved in various activism stuff. Biz Stone was a very sort of militant vegan and interested in animal rights issues. And a couple of us were involved in the anti-globalization and anti-authoritarian movements in North America. And so we've been trying to figure out how to apply technology to these social movements. And in our spare time, while we had day jobs. And so interesting experiments on how to democratize the media and how to give people voices was also sort of interesting from a business perspective, not to try and exploit it, but to learn from it and popularize it. And so I myself and a couple of other people have been very involved with Indie Media and ProtestNet and Resist.ca and a bunch of these sort of radical tech collectives and trying to develop technology for social change. And I think that when we looked at the values and the way Twitter is designed, the way in which it was open, the way in which was participatory, the way in which there was no approval process and everyone could get a voice, and then people could democratically choose who they listened to. Those values are parallel to a lot of the values of leftist social movements about what would a mass communications medium look like if we were inventing it from scratch today.
So the Twitter today is obviously very different than the Twitter origins you just described. Looking at it today, what good is it still for activists? How do activists use it, and how does it relate to those origins?
Well, Twitter today is still a really powerful force in terms of getting information to the media. It's still a very useful force for coordinating. It's a very public medium, so it's not a private, closed group type of collaboration. But people can create things on Twitter and get tremendous resonance in a larger society. And so if you're engaged in activity where you're trying to push ideas out there or spread ideas or change the way people think about things, Twitter is an incredibly accessible democratic way of doing that. Because rather than putting out a press release or building a relationship with a reporter, you can tweet, say, images of a protest or videos and get them retweeted. And if you have the right language and people sending it, you can create these cascading effects of memes. And those are powerful. And those are free to do. You have to realize the constraints of the medium, but Twitter lets people have this network effect that a decade ago just didn't exist.
We've heard now about these so-called Twitter revolutions, but Twitter can also be a dangerous tool for activists, no?
Sure. So Twitter, the company, actually attempts to support activists. There's a number of radical anarchist cryptographers and security geeks, one guy named Moxie, who actually spent a year working for the company on their security stuff. So as far as a company, they actually care about their users, and they care about protecting their privacy and protecting the way people communicate and protecting them. But the extent that they can care is limited to the fact that they are a corporation incorporated in the United States, and so they have to follow U.S. law. They can fight through the courts when they get orders they think are unfair, but eventually, in the end of the day, they have to exist within the U.S. legal system, and so that constrains them a lot. And Twitter is not a place where you should coordinate publishing and doing civil disobedience, for example, because it doesn't have that kind of privacy. Doesn't have that kind of thing, but it is a company that likes that people use itself for political means. Facebook was probably used more in the Arab Spring than Twitter, but Facebook was not at all happy about it being used for revolutions, so they didn't embrace it. They didn't celebrate it. Twitter, as a company, even today, celebrated its use in those cases, and so people talk about Twitter revolutions and they don't talk about YouTube revolutions or Facebook revolutions, but really the three of those mediums and blogs and cell phones and face-to-face meetings and protests, all the other things, they were all used. Ironically enough, we talk about more of a Twitter revolution because Twitter, the company, is happy to talk about that and support the narrative.
So we're now in month two of the Snowden revelations. Does the NSA have direct access or any form of access to Twitter data?
Well, clearly they've figured out a way to get access. I have no idea if Twitter, the company today, has made an agreement with them, or if the NSA has just put something upstream with it, or if the NSA just asked for a copy of Google or Microsoft's copy of the Twitter database, because Twitter sells a copy of all the public tweets in real time to Microsoft and Google. So they don't even actually have to go back to Twitter, the company, to get a copy of all the public tweets. Or they could put a tap on the fiber. The Twitter data center is in Utah. It wouldn't be very hard to go and tap the fiber right out the side of the data center, or with a court order proof that they had to put something in the data center. But I don't know. But I would assume that everything you put on Twitter, just like everything you publish everywhere else on the internet, private or public, encrypted or not, is all copied and archived by the NSA.
So yesterday in your talk and just now, you mentioned a few stories of the inside discussions of Twitter and how certain fractions argued over the direction it was going. You also mentioned there's going to be some new revelations and a book that you're pretty anticipating. What is it? What is it about and when is it coming out?
So the book is called Hatching Twitter, and it's by a New York Times author, Nick Bilton. And he went back and he interviewed all of the people involved. And the biggest revelation of the book is that there was the people that Twitter Incorporated, the company, say are the founders of the company, aren't exactly the real founders of the company. They are the people who created Twitter. The real guy who founded the company of Odeo and created Twitter and came up with a name, came up with a design, pushed through the idea, and was sort of the driving force of it was this guy named Noah Glass. And through a whole bunch of rather unsavory deals and probably legal but underhanded machinations, Noah got written out of history and written out of the ownership of the company that he founded and he created and he named. And so this guy, Noah Glass, is someone who has been made to sort of disappear from all the narratives. And the people who pushed him out end up getting to be the heroes on TV. And so it's going to be very fascinating when the book comes out, because it's very well documented, what happened and sort of sets the record straight.
Well, why was he pushed out and how did that happen?
He was pushed out because the board of directors of the company and this guy, Evan Williams, who had the money to pay for everything, felt that he was too creative and disruptive. You know, we have someone who is incredibly brilliant and creative, and yet they also, because they burn so brightly, they're sometimes difficult to deal with. And rather than finding a way in which Noah can be incredibly creative and insightful and build new things, they decided to just take his stock away and fire him. And he's the guy who named Twitter. It was his idea. He was the guy who pushed it forward, and he just got screwed. And out of billions of dollars.
Wow. I will be looking forward to the book. Well, thanks for all those insights, Rebel. It was nice having you.
Thank you very much.